Blog Talk Radio.
Tired of disinformation, distractions, and deceit? Looking for a shining ray of honesty and reality? There's a lot to see in the world, but first, you've got to look. The View from Montana. Perhaps you have a spark of truth to add to the flickering light of liberty. Remember, a can of worms won't open itself. Together, we can keep the fires of freedom and truth alive. Together, we are idle no more. Welcome to The View from Montana.
Thank you, everybody, and welcome to The View from Montana. The last couple of weeks, if you follow The View from Montana, you'll notice that I haven't had my regular show every Thursday. I said that I will have only special shows regarding special issues, regarding issues that affect not just a little local area in your neck of the woods, but an extended area, not only here in Montana, but possibly other states. And if you've been following us, we've been following the CSKT, Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, Water Compact. I hate to call it Water Rights Compact, but that's what it is. This is big, folks, and we're coming down to the line. We have Elaine Willman, and this is the second time she's on. She's going to give us an update, and it's important. We've had people from the Western Montana Water Rights Group. Thank you, every single one of you. It was a small, dedicated group that stopped this compact in 2013 because it was very questionable, and it's a good thing they did. And so now it's coming up again in the Montana legislature. And the showdown, I think, is going to be this Saturday, April 11th. And so Elaine is on, and I'm going to give her the floor, and she's going to start talking. And if you have any questions or comments, she will be the one to open it up. If you have any questions or comments on the chat room, please be free to go in there also. This is very important, folks, and Elaine is going to tell you why it goes beyond just a question of water. Elaine, thank you, and welcome to The View from
Thank you, Elena. One moment, please.
Sure.
Wendy, I'm on a talk show. I'll have to talk to you later. Thanks. Bye. My daughter has been frantically trying to reach me just as we were coming on the air, so my apologies. I want to thank you first, Elena, for having me on. I am going to be out in the Montana area again very soon. And as a matter of fact, I plan to attend the Saturday, April 11th House Judiciary Committee hearing and to provide some testimony there. And I certainly hope everybody listening considers also attending. This is on Senate Bill 262. Sponsored by Senator Chaz Vincent. Senate Bill, the printer-friendly version of Senate Bill 262 is 140 pages. I have been going over and over that as best I can get through it without having to consume enormous quantities of Maalox. This is a beast. Senate Bill 262 is the implementing legislation to the proposed CSKT compact. And the problems are on every page, every one of the 140 pages in this bill. The big picture in my mind is that this, right on page one, recitals under Senate Bill 262, there is authority for the U.S. Attorney General's office. There is authority for the Salish Kootenai Tribe. There is authority for the Secretary of Interior, who will execute and implement the proposed Salish-Kootenai Compact, Water Rights Compact. That means the Secretary of Interior has the only authority to execute, and that means that the Bureau of Indian Affairs will implement this whole compact on behalf of the Salish-Kootenai tribe. That's a huge problem right there. What's missing under authorities in the recitals on page one is the state of Montana. The way, the tone of this 140 pages, the content of this 140 pages, it's like a Christmas wish list for the Salish-Kootenai tribe. It is written in their voice, on their behalf, and for them entirely. And the state of Montana's role is basically a signatory and a party that will comply. So the tone is wrong, the content is wrong. I don't see any of it that comports with the rule of law. And that's kind of a broad statement to make, but I, honest to God, do not see anything within this 140-page bill that has been kind of foisted upon the legislator, the state legislators, as complying with the law. And by the law, I mean the state of Montana's constitution, the U.S. Constitution, the environmental policy mandates, the Winters Doctrine, several Supreme Court cases. This document circumvents the law. I mean entirely circumvents it. And what is most troubling to me, I've been looking and tracking this issue for a couple of years, but the legislature and Montana attorneys and the governors, but I think going at least as far back as former Governor Schweitzer, have been at the wheel putting this compact together for at least 10 years. Now, one would think with all those legal eyes and all that length of time and effort that this would be a document that is entirely compliant with the law. And it's not. It's really not. And it's quite dangerous. One of the reasons this is about much more than water is because there is a transfer of jurisdiction. There is an abdication of the state's protections and responsibilities to the residents in 11 counties that receive water, whether it's through irrigation or off-reservation if it's a municipality. There is an abdication of the state protections and authorities over water for 11 counties. It's a complete walk away by the state over its water in those 11 counties. And then it's authorizing the Salish-Kootenai tribe to have priority over all the streams, tributaries, rivers in those counties, and to further prioritize in-stream flows and ramp them up. And as they prioritize in-stream flows on and off the reservation and ramp up those flows, they will reduce irrigation water available to those that need the irrigation water. It's kind of a competition where the in-stream flow needs will supersede irrigation needs. That's the tone of this whole thing. I remember attending in September, I think it was September 7th or thereabouts, a hearing in Helena. I can't quite remember. Oh, it was the WPIC committee, a WPIC committee hearing in September. I attended, and I remembered pointing out at that point in the process, back in September, that there was no waiver of sovereign immunity in this document, and that lacking a waiver of sovereign immunity, the tribe could never be held accountable for any violations of this this legislation or this compact. Well, so they fixed that. And let me give you an example of the legal gymnastics that have gone into this document as to how they fixed it. On page 46, they waive the sovereign immunity of the state of Montana, even its 11th Amendment constitutional immunity. They waive that. And they say, except as to, they waive their sovereign immunity for the tribe and the state, except as to any monetary damages, compensation, attorney's fees, or costs. So the message in their waiver of sovereign immunity on page 46 of this bill is, we waive our sovereign immunity. You can sue us, either the state or the tribe, all day long, but you'll never collect a dime. That's the language in the waiver of sovereign immunity on page 46. Then you go right to page 48, and there's a little disclaimer that says, nothing else in this document, nothing else in this bill constitutes any waiver of immunity. Then you go to page 76, and you find, oh, by the way, commissioners, board members, staffs, any individual who is an implementer of this compact is immune from suit. So there's the convolution. They say, oh, we fixed it. We put a waiver of sovereign immunity, except you'll never collect a dime from anybody. And we put in an exclusion that nothing else in this document waives immunity. And then another paragraph that says, and oh, by the way, anybody that works on this compact or has a thing to do with this compact cannot be sued. That's the way they covered waiver of sovereign immunity. That's disgusting. That's in my mind, that's a number of legal counsels totally familiar with the importance of what a true and legitimate waiver of sovereign immunity means, persuading legislators that, oh, we fixed it, it's good, not to worry, when it's empty. There is no waiver in there. The contradictory paragraphs, one page after another, wipe out any reference to a waiver of sovereign immunity, but they put the language in there so you can see, well, there it is. There it is, but you can't collect any money. There it is, but no person accountable for this compact can be sued. That's an example of I call it legal gymnastics. We'll say one thing, but then we'll take it out here. Well, we'll put it in here so everybody feels good, and then we'll take it out there. Those are the kinds of examples of what is in this compact. It's very difficult. I mean, there's so many appendices and 1,400 pages or something like that of the original compact. But this Senate bill, 262, identifies the major pieces, and they're pretty egregious. Another thing that really bothers me about this compact, and by the way, I really hope callers will call in, because I'm one that really enjoys hearing comments, taking questions. I think that enriches the conversation. I don't like to hear myself talk all the time, so I do hope people will call in or send in emails, and Elena, you can tell me what they're thinking or asking.
Well, Wayne, I just want to jump in right now. You've got a heck of a lot of people that are listening right now, and
good.
So they're learning. And if any questions come up, I will put them through to you. And again, folks, if you have any questions, just call in 1-646-564-9915 and then press 1, and then I'll put you in the queue. I have a couple of questions, if you don't mind, Elaine.
Sure.
A term that's come up is for a forever compact.
Yes.
If you
yes.
can go into that and explain that one, and also that I'm sure you're aware of the fact that they said you can't, the legislature cannot amend any part of this.
Yes.
SB 262.
Yes, I've heard both, and I have thoughts on both. In terms of the perpetuity or the foreverness of this compact, that is another fatal flaw. That is absolutely illegal. We had that occur here in Wisconsin, where I live, years ago before I moved here, when former Governor James Doyle executed ridiculous gaming compacts with 10 of the 11 tribes here. Very lucrative gaming compacts for the tribe and not so much for the state, and he executed those compacts in perpetuity. The state legislature wasn't going to have anything to do with that, and the state legislature sued former Governor Jim Doyle and said, you may not handcuff the decisions of future elected officials. You may not put a piece of policy into place that can never be addressed by future elected officials. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled in favor of that state legislature and agreed. And he had to go back and revise those compacts in a manner consistent with the comfort level of the Wisconsin state legislature and with a time frame and reviewable time periods even within the gaming compacts. So I'm guessing that as it goes for handcuffing elected officials in Wisconsin, you may not do that either in Montana. And that's that perpetuity thing is just one of those little minor things that's sort of puzzling to legislators. But they really ought to know they have terms, and in Wisconsin, I mean in Montana, I believe they term out after 16 years. New legislators will come in, and they will have to live with this and be unable to serve their constituents. So that perpetuity is going to be very easily challengeable in court, and that perpetuity should really catch the ear of the current legislators, many of whom still have many years to go and won't be able to do a thing once this is passed. So that's on that. And then what was the other thing, Elena? Amending it, about how the
right,
contract,
yeah,
can,
they
compact
keep
cannot
saying
be amended.
You cannot amend it. I mean, that
yes.
should throw up a whole bunch of red
yeah.
flags.
And they say the reason that I've heard that's been explained as to why the state cannot amend the compact is because it's a compact, it's an intergovernmental compact with a federal tribal government and with the federal government itself. And for the state to amend, make any kind of amendment in the compact, then the whole thing has to be reopened, reexamined. Amendments have to be agreed upon by the tribe, by the federal government. And so it's just not possible to amend. You know, that's another thing that handcuffs current and future legislators. And it's another flaw. With intergovernmental agreements, and the Supreme Court has ruled on a couple of them very recently, with intergovernmental agreements, there is always an amendment process. There has to be for future elected officials or for problems. That's just kind of another little piece missing in action in this Senate Bill 262 and in the compact itself. So that's yet another problem, huge problem. Speaking of Supreme Court rulings on intergovernmental agreements, there's a very recent one. U.S. Supreme Court is called Kansas versus Nebraska and Colorado. Just came out last month, March, from the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's an intergovernmental agreement between those three states. Now, it could be with two states and a tribe, but it's an intergovernmental agreement, and as such, it has a congressional ratification. And as such, when there's a dispute, the ultimate answer comes from the U.S. Supreme Court. That Kansas versus Nebraska ruling was a water compact where the Mississippi and the rivers that roll through Nebraska roll south through Kansas and into a piece of Colorado. So there's a discussion in that Supreme Court case about upstream river, upstream states, and downstream states. And the discussion was about Kansas was accusing Nebraska of holding off and holding up too and using too much water that was making less water available to Kansas. And that's what the issue was that went up to the Supreme Court. Within that Supreme Court ruling on a water agreement, intergovernmental water agreement, there were two big points the Supreme Court is making. First is that any intergovernmental agreement must serve a public interest. And just think about this Salish Kootenai Compact, Water Compact. What on earth is the public interest? The Supreme Court says any intergovernmental agreement must serve a public interest. And the second big principle of intergovernmental agreements is it must serve a purpose of justice. I wonder what the justice is of handing all the waters in 11 counties to 5,000 people of a small tribe and depriving 350,000 people in 11 counties of their normal use of water and protections of water provided by the state of Montana. Not so much justice in this compact either. No public interest is served, no justice is served. And that's a fresh case off of the U.S. Supreme Court, a water case for an intergovernmental agreement. Kansas versus Nebraska came out in March of this year. So when I look at what the Supreme Court is trying to tell states and trying to tell parties to intergovernmental agreements, one would think Attorney General Tim Fox would pay attention to things like that, or any of the legal counsel would pay attention to things like that over a period of 10 years of looking at this. And then there's another recent case in the Supreme Court that's critical, Tarrant versus Herman. That came out in 2013, and that was also an intergovernmental agreement between four states, Oklahoma, Kansas, Arkansas, and Texas. Again, sharing water. It was a water, intergovernmental water agreement. Could have been three states and a tribe, or two states and two tribes. Intergovernmental water agreement of sharing waters. That was Tarrant versus Herman. And all those four states decided they would share their waters with each other as needed and as agreed upon. And then Arkansas had an occasion where it wanted some water from Oklahoma at a time Oklahoma did not feel it had water to give. And so hence that case went into court. And that went up to the Supreme Court. Now that ruling was 9-0. Even your most liberal justices, 9-0, unanimous Tarrant versus Herman ruling in 2013. And it said states have the absolute right and authority to all waters and the soils beneath them for all lands ceded to a state upon a statehood. Now, the reason that case is so critical is because the tribe, with the wholehearted approval and blessing of all of your state attorneys, are claiming aboriginal rights and time immemorial rights. So it begs the question, how can a state, in accordance with the Supreme Court, own all of its waters, ceded to it at statehood, how can that fit with aboriginal and time immemorial rights? It does not. It does not. I mean, common sense, it's not even consistent. And aboriginal and time immemorial rights are really phrases that come out of Canada. And the Northwest tribes just love to parrot the Canadian tribes. But the United States has a constitution, and everything has to be within the four corners of the constitution, and most certainly aboriginal and time immemorial rights are not. Think about it for a moment. What if tribes really had within the constitution, what if they really had aboriginal and time immemorial rights? That means that anything they wanted to do, anything any of the 566 tribes across the United States, anything that the tribes want to do under the claim of aboriginal rights would be pre-constitutional, and the Constitution would be irrelevant, entirely irrelevant. That's why it's not legal in the United States. The Constitution is not irrelevant, except as it has been rendered irrelevant in this Senate Bill 262. It's been the U.S. Constitution, the Montana State Constitution, has been rendered irrelevant in this bill. And yet everybody's
Elaine,
focusing on the... Yes?
If I don't want to interrupt your thinking and your train on this thing, but we do have a question.
Sure.
What is the real stat... This is on the chat room. What's the real status of the CSKT tribe? Is it a corporation or a tribal government?
It is a federally chartered tribal government, and it has a federal charter, which is a corporation. Its federal charter is a corporation, and they're identified as the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribe. They were the first tribe in the United States recognized under the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. They were tribe number one that came in under that. Now, the interesting thing about that is that they almost never mention that they're a federally recognized tribe under the Indian Reorganization Act, because that's when they had governing authority over lands in 1934. Prior to that, under the Treaty of 1855, they had beneficial use and occupancy of land, but not title and not jurisdiction. But they like that 1855 treaty and they like to use that point of reference as, oh, we had jurisdiction. No, that Treaty of Hellgate in 1855 created a bounded area for two or three tribes, and it would accommodate more to live in total protection by the federal government and to have entire beneficial use and occupancy without intrusion. That's what the treaty was set up for. They did not own the land. The United States owned the land. And then later, with the Allotment Act and the Homestead Act, the United States started transferring its title to individual Indians and to individual homesteaders, and a good portion of the reservation was no longer even under the title of the United States. The allottees became citizens of their state, and the allottees became Montana taxpayers, as did the homesteaders. So the reservation started dividing up somewhat. There's still substantial land that belongs to the Salish Kootenai that is federal trust land today, but it's not the whole cloth that was created by the Hellgate Treaty. And they did not have the jurisdictional authority under the Hellgate Treaty that they have as of 1934 as a federally chartered tribe.
Okay. I hope that answers that one question. We've got another one, though. Are you familiar with the Farm, F-A-R-M group? And the question is, where did the money for the media blitz to support the Montana Compact Farm Group come from?
I have heard of them. I have no clue what their source of funding is. I understand it's been enormous, and there's been a real media blitz. One of the things, you know, I've met some wonderful Montana people, and one of the things I see Montana people as having, including your legislators, is that they have common sense. Just common sense, most of the time.
We hope so.
You know what I mean? So when there is a good bill, when there is something that is transparent and openly debated and agreed upon, folks tend to get behind that. And good legislation tends to sail through without a problem. About the time you're crafting something for over 10 years, and people are uninformed for most of those 10 years, and everybody's just told, oh, it's a good thing. We'll pass this and you'll see what's in it. It's a good thing. Not to worry. And then people start snapping to the problems within the bill or the legislation, and people start speaking up, and it gets noisy. And I'm so proud of Montana citizens now. Their opposition is enormous, and it is so necessary. When you have to work that hard to pass legislation, and somebody who will profit down the road somewhere, those who foresee themselves as benefiting from this beast, will put up millions to do the media blitz. That should be a signal to every person with common sense in Montana that there's something wrong here. There's something really fundamentally wrong here. And one of the things that's fundamentally wrong is another little legal gymnastics game played in that bill. And that is that they use the word, there's no precedent. Nothing in this bill sets a precedent. And they say this is not a precedent, nothing in this bill sets a precedent, on multiple pages in the bill. You know, the reason for that is because, number one, that the legislature nor anyone can instruct a court, a state or federal court, as to what is precedent or what is not. That's a court determination. That's not Montana staff or legal counsel. Precedent is a court's determination. So when they pepper the paper in that bill with, oh, this doesn't set a precedent, this doesn't, not to worry, this isn't, the other tribes aren't going to get this, well, they will. The moment this bill is passed, where your other compacts across Montana do not include off-reservation waters and all the in-stream flow and ownership of the wetlands, you know, where those other compacts already executed were put through very quietly because they were fundamentally in compliance with the law. They really did the Federal Reserve water rights under the Winters Doctrine. They really were fundamentally in compliance with the law, the other six compacts. This one is so wildly different that they've had to say, oh, not to worry, the other tribes won't get this because there's no precedent-setting element in here. That's BS. That really is. And the moment this is passed, the other six tribes are going to say, Montana has to treat us equally, the way it treats the Salish Kootenai. And then the next thing you know, those other compacts will be opened, and the feds and tribes can amend them, just not the state. And those other compacts will be reopened, and they'll get their off-reservation waters and aboriginal rights and time immemorial. And the next thing you know, the federal government will own Montana's waters that the Supreme Court says belong to the state. That's where this is
now,
moving,
I read
and that's
something.
Why it's so dangerous.
I read something about the Blackfoot
yes.
tribe, and that they were kind of bringing back, they settled, and now they're rescinded their compact, and somebody
mm-hmm.
in the chat room also brought up the fact
mm-hmm.
that they're in D.C.,
mm-hmm. right.
of corruption,
I read
them
about that
doing
too.
Something right now.
Yeah,
so
I haven't been following
that?
The Blackfeet. I haven't been following the Blackfeet, but if you consider where they're located, north of the Salish Kootenai and up in northwest Montana, and that, you know, they have a compact, there's some competition for the waters between the Blackfeet and the Salish Kootenai, so they're understandably not pleased with some of that. But the other thing is, they're already gearing up to go get all that they can, too, if there's anything remaining after the Salish Kootenai tribe grabs all those waters. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife owns a good number of the waters up in that area. And, oh, here's the other interesting piece. The I believe that the crafters of that bill really, truly, in their heart of hearts, know that Aboriginal rights and time immemorial is bogus. But they've identified those rights along all the streams and tributaries throughout the 11 counties. So they have a cute little plan B, and that is that within the bill, the tribe will co-own with the Montana Fish and Wildlife and Parks Department, the MFWP. They will co-own the waters currently owned by the MFWP, and they will co-own all the wetlands currently owned by the MFWP. Well, think about this for a minute. How does a tribal government co-own state waters when those tribal waters are going to be put into federal trust on behalf of the tribe? How do you divide the water up? I mean, common sense. That's the kind of legal gymnastics that are in that bill. And it's just folly. And it's just excessive. I won't hold the tribe, the Salish Kootenai tribe, entirely accountable for that, because the federal government is rolling out across the country and using reservations and tribal governments as pawns to capture state waters and capture natural resources and to neuter state authority everywhere it can. Right now, the EPA is doing it big time in Wyoming, the BLM in Nevada, across the western states. The BIA is going to be the implementer of this Salish Kootenai Compact. And these are all federal agencies just trampling state authorities and state rights and grabbing state resources using the tribes as puppets and pawns. And, of course, most of the tribal members that I've met when I've been out there before also oppose this. They're property owners. They need the water. They're not going to be treated any better than anybody else. But there's a few tribal government leaders that, you know, feel the power and feel very special, according to the feds. And Katie barred the door. And so it's up to the Montana citizens.
It seems like a lot of the alphabet agencies are coming in from
mm-hmm.
all, you know, doors, and basically they want to take control over our water. And when they do that, they can take control over us. One of the other things that's been being brought up recently is this compact, if it's approved, it basically also gives any member of the CSKT, the right to come over your land, to go fishing where they want, hunting where they want. Have you heard something about that? I mean, it's almost like they have the right to come on your land and do whatever they want.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about that?
Well, That has happened on the coast of Washington State, and that's been litigated on the coast of Washington State, and they've carved out some protections for, there are property owners along the beaches on the coast of Washington State, and there are a number of Indian tribes on the coastal area of Washington State, and property owners were, and in Idaho too, with an abandoned railway, tribes exercising their right to fish and hunt and pick and gather in their usual and accustomed areas, even off of their reservation, were traipsing through private properties, whether they were on the beaches in Washington or along an abandoned railway in Idaho. In Washington, those issues were litigated, and some protections were put in for the property owners that a tribal member had to notify a property owner in advance, I think 24 hours in advance, that they wanted to come through their property to the beach for shell fishing and things of that matter. But it is a serious issue. Most of the Stevens treaties did provide that tribal members may hunt and gather and fish in their ceded areas, and that's outside of the boundaries of their regular reservation. And that can present problems for tribal members. Now, how this plays out in the Salish Kootenai on the Flathead Reservation, I'm not exactly sure, but that's a dicey issue. All of us are property owners. I mean, you and I and most folks wouldn't traipse through somebody's private property without saying please, at least, or saying, you know, mother, something. But so there's a certain risk that a stranger walking through a private property is taking, for one thing. So that's something that I would strongly encourage tribal members and property owners to discuss with each other. I mean, if there's a specific hunting area and there's some private properties in that area, it behooves the tribal members to knock on the door of the property owner and say, hey, we're allowed to fish here or hunt here, but we want to be courteous. I mean, there's a way to be neighborly and to be polite and to honor that treaty, honor their right, by just common courtesy. When you approach and say, I have the right to, well, maybe so. But courtesy goes an awful long way in advance notice. So that doesn't just take away from the right. It's, again, common sense and safety for all concerned, you know.
Well, here's another thing, that a question that I've had, you know, and I've seen this from other people too, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, that this compact includes the state having to contribute, for lack of a better word, $55
yeah.
million dollars
yeah.
to this thing.
Yeah.
And I understand that,
is, yeah.
that part of it is going to be used for meters and for what? Do you know?
Well, this compact includes every form of water, not just free-flowing through the streams and tributaries, but underground water as well, and the wetlands and all things that are water are memorialized as a tribal water right in this compact. In terms of the contribution to the settlement, that's Article 6 of the Senate Bill 262, and it identifies and memorializes a total of $55 million to be delivered to the tribe. Now, Article 6 is contributions to the settlement. I've heard that the federal government is going to be contributing in excess of $1 billion to the tribe. Under Article 6, contributions to the settlement, the only contributions to the settlement are those of the state to the tune of $55 million. There's no contributions from the tribe coming towards the settlement, and no contributions identified for the federal government under this settlement either. So I don't know if the federal government is just kind of saying, yeah, we're going to give you $1 billion or so once we get this, but there's no obligation of the federal government in this act to contribute under the Article 6 contributions to the settlement. The federal contribution is missing.
You know, you can call me paranoid. You can call me a conspiracy theorist. You can call me whatever you want. But right now, you know, and we all know that there is this big thing about a drought in California. And, you know, I think you probably heard about Nestle, bottling water plant, and they're taking the water in California, putting it in bottles, and then selling it to the people. And then, which I think that's a lot of money that could be made. And I'm just thinking, what about the, once this, correct me if I'm wrong, but if this compact goes through, it basically gives the CSKT tribe almost control over water. And now they're going to have $55 million to set up meters. And then they can also have, could they possibly sell this water or bottle it if they want and sell it to other states that are experiencing a drought? Could they do that?
Well, it's very interesting that you should ask that question, Elena, because just the other day, you know, I track what's going on in federal Indian policy across the country, and there are particular websites that I go to for all the national Indian news and what's going on. Just this month of April, in a law journal called The Federal Lawyer, is an article out of the University of New Mexico by Jeanette Wolfley. I believe her last name is spelled, Wolfley, W-O-L-F-L-E-Y. An article by Jeanette Wolfley. She's academia at the University of New Mexico Law School. And this is out of the Federal Lawyer Journal, quarterly journal where attorneys write their grand ideas. And this is called As Long as the Water Shall Flow, Bringing Water to Tribal Homelands. Now, mind you, this was just published this month of April, and today's only the 6th. So this is just out. And what it says, this it's not a long law journal article, but it's well worth reading, and I can't miss the coincidental timing of this with the water grabs that tribal governments are doing in the Northwest. This is strongly encouraging tribes to capture all the waters that they can and then to market those waters for economic development for the tribe. So does that ring a little bell? Here the state of Montana is giving them more water than they could ever use with 5,000 tribal members in a small partial reservation. And the state of Montana is saying, here, take all of our water forever. And then comes this Law Journal article from Jeanette Wolfley, April 2015, just out, saying tribes need to start considering using water, capturing water, and using water as for marketing and economic development for their tribal government. That should scare the bejesus out of every state that has an Indian tribe. You know?
Yeah,
so that's where it's going. That's where it's going. The attorneys, especially the University of New Mexico Law School, I was invited there to a symposium once several years ago, and I was the only non-Indian on the program. The University of New Mexico is extremely radical law school that was very, very pro-tribal government issues. And when I say that, I'm speaking of tribal government, certainly not tribal culture, because I'm very pro-tribal culture and tribal people. And there's a huge difference. But there is such a big, big, wealthy legal industry nibbling at the edges and pushing tribal government authority and jurisdiction and governance over natural resources. And now the feds are throwing out billions for energy programs to tribe. There's such a big legal industry and such big money on that side of the issue. The law schools, which are, you know, many law schools receive $1 million endowments of a chair in the law school from a gaming tribe. Law schools are really pushing tribes to overstep their bounds. And we're really close. I think at a national level, what's going on in New York, what's going on in California, there's an awful lot of water flowing out of California right into the ocean to save the fish and not the people, you know.
Yeah, and when you think about it, it's basically I've been looking and following stuff about California and the drought situation in California,
mm-hmm.
and it just bothers me what's going on over there, and it bothers me because Montana, supposedly, we don't have a drought situation or immediate drought situation, and we're just giving an option where the water can be bottled and sent out of the state, and then where does that leave the rest of us?
Yeah. Well, you know, the southwestern states, particularly California, but the southwestern states themselves really covet the waters here in the Great Lakes and the waters that are coming out of the Columbia. The northern half of the states are very fortunate for the most part for water. Certainly the Northwest and the Midwest here are very, very fortunate for having an abundant supply of water. And by and large, the states have managed them quite well. But just like private sector used to manage health care reasonably well, the feds are coming in to take over the waters now. And the tribes will be able to use it for economic development. So
We have another question, and I don't know. This is about an environmental impact. EIS done?
That's another piece I wanted to address because also in September when I gave a testimony, one of the laws that are being violated are the federal mandates under the National Environmental Policy Act and the state mandates under Montana's Environmental Policy Act. Those are mandates. That if you, Elena, own a piece of ground and you want to do something that's going to significantly disturb the environment, you're going to have to do at least an environmental assessment or show the state or the feds that whatever you want to do is not going to have any significant environmental impact. Those are mandates. But we are told, and I've heard this from numerous legal counsel guiding the legislators, that, oh, no, the compact doesn't need, we don't need to do an environmental policy impact statement for the compact. Oh, no, it's just a piece of legislature. It's not a state agency. It's just a bill, you know. Well, my career has not been in federal Indian policy, although it has the last 20 years, but my career is as a professional planner working in California and Washington State and now here in Wisconsin. I've written environmental impact statements. I've reviewed them over the years. And there's some pretty interesting gymnastics going on there, too. I watched a video in which Senator Chaz Vincent was giving a talk somewhere up in Lincoln County. I think it might have been Eureka. I'm not sure where, a month or so ago. And I heard him say that, no, it wasn't necessary to do an environmental impact statement or an economic study. And besides, the state didn't have the available resources to do those things. That was the statement from Senator Vincent. Now, mind you, they've been working on this bill for over 10 years, and they've had all kinds of resources to craft this monster, but they can't come up with the resources to comply with the mandates of the National Environmental Policy Act. They cannot and did not ever do an economic study. Had they done either or, and the NEPA really requires an economic study, it has a socioeconomic component to it. Had they done that, we wouldn't be struggling, staying awake at night, worrying about this beast that the state legislature may pass. And I don't even fault the legislators. I don't even fault the legislators that support the bill anymore. I fault the attorneys that have had their fingers on these papers for 10 years and have circumvented the law. They have not made the effort to adhere to the law. So let me tell you what the law says, what the National Environmental Policy Act says regarding what needs an environmental impact statement. I heard, I think it was Ms. Hornbein or Ms. Thigpen, I'm not sure which, one of those attorneys that guides the legislature, was saying that, oh, no, it's the legislature, this bill is categorically excluded. Well, categorical exclusions are a phrase from NEPA. So they didn't have to, because this is just a piece of paper, you know. So So here's what a here's when a categorical exclusion may occur. It says categorical exclusion means a category of action actions which do not individually or cumulatively have a significant effect on the human environment, and which have been found to have no such effect in procedures adopted by agencies. Now, let me say this again: do not have individual or cumulative significant effects on the human environment. Now, just think about this compact, what the state's about to do, abdicating its waters and handing them off to a tribe and redirecting, prioritizing in-stream flows and reducing irrigation flows. Wouldn't you think that has just a little significant effect on the human environment in 11 counties? See, they have to do
this. Yeah, I would think so.
And they have not done that. And they refuse to do that. And all those attorneys for all those years are saying, oh, not to worry. But here's another thing. Maybe it's just a piece of paper. If the piece of paper did not exist and was not passed, there's no significant effects of any kind. But because it exists, there's a legal term called sine qua non. It means but for. Sine qua non is a legal term that says, but for this piece of paper, you know, there's going to be horrendous environmental impacts throughout 11 counties. And, you know, so there's no way that something of this substance and of this geography, we're talking 40,000 square miles, we're talking one-fifth of Montana's land base, we're talking one-third of its population, and you have attorneys that are getting nice salaries in Montana saying, oh, no, no impacts here, not to worry.
Yeah.
I think that's just outrageous. And
somehow... Yeah, and I think also it's just only within, well, last year, the year before, most of the counties, the 11 counties that you speak about, they really didn't even think that this had anything to do with them. And again,
no.
I'm just going to put a plug in for the Western Montana Water Rights Group. Look it up, folks.
Yes.
These people were dedicated, a small group that if it wasn't for them, this would have been a done deal in 2013. Which brings me to Mr. Chaz Vincent. He supposedly was against it back in 2013, and now all of a sudden he's for it. I voted against it, but now I'm for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see any major changes in the compact.
I think there have
major?
Been. I don't know what the original compacts looked back, starting, you know, what the original discussions and drafts looked like, say, 5-6 years ago or even 2 years ago. But I think an awful lot has been piled in here that maybe wasn't in there before, like co-owning the MFWP waters and wetlands. There's a lot that's plugged in that really ramps up the full authority and control and management by the BIA on behalf of the tribe of all these waters. I think as it's been successfully stopped a couple of years ago, and that's to the credit of the folks at the Montana Water Users, Dr. Kate and Terry's group, they stopped it. But I think once they stopped it, it also gave the those mysterious folks that think they're going to benefit from this, gave them opportunity to load it up some more. And that's what they did. They've loaded it up. They've loaded this up to
the maximum capacity. So then Vincent, he said he was against it before, but now that they loaded it up, he's for it?
I don't know. I certainly can't speak his mind. I certainly can't speak for Senator Vincent. I surely can't read his mind, and I don't know why he would change his mind, and I don't know why he would say, he would make a statement as goofy as, the state doesn't have the available resources to do an economic study or an environmental impact study. They certainly have just poured millions of dollars into this draft process over the years. It would be maybe $1 million to do the environmental impact statement, maybe $500,000 to do a decent economic study. But had those two pieces been done, none of us would be here today looking at this compact, because it would not be happening. You know, so I don't understand.
I have two other things.
I just wanted to say one more thing. I'm not willing. I was initially. I'm going to be straight, because when I first came out in September and I was listening to supporters of the compact, I thought, they've got to be crazy. But more recently, over the past 6 months, I've been reading the writings of the attorneys advising the legislators. And, you know, if I'm an elected official and a legislator and I have an attorney that is guiding my committee or an attorney general who is guiding me, my tendency would be to believe that they're telling me the truth, to believe that they're adhering to the law. That would be my tendency. So I place the fault and the flaws and the circumventing of the law in this compact squarely at the feet of all those state-paid legal counsel who have been patting legislators on the head saying, oh, it's a good thing, it's okay, it's okay. Because, you know, not all legislators are attorneys. I guess I'm willing to give some legislators the benefit of the doubt. They have been as misled and as misinformed as the public on some of this. I mean, you have an attorney general who hasn't even mentioned what Tarrant versus Herman means to the state of Montana, or who hasn't even looked at what the Supreme Court says an intergovernmental agreement must do, serve a public interest, serve a public justice. You have an attorney general that has not buzzed these cases to the legislators and said, let's see how the compact measures up to these. No. I think your legal system is the corrupt place, more so than your elected officials. I really do.
Oh, I'm sure of that, because, you know, the Attorney General for Montana, for you folks that don't know, is Tim Fox, and supposedly he's a Republican. Okay, and our governor, who is Steve Bullock, who is a Democrat, and they're just nose to nose on this thing, which just blows me away. I don't know why, and I don't know why these. Let me just say something, because this bothers me, really. In Montana, both houses have a majority, and they're supposedly the Republicans, and they're supposed to be conservatives and all this other stuff. And some of these bills, the SB 262 is one of them, the compact, have gotten through because you had a number of so-called conservative Republicans, Chaz Vincent, one of them, who are voting for the Democrats, who are the minority. And I don't get that. It just bothers me. And like I said, I don't think if you listen to the people that are aware of what's going on with this compact, they're basically not floored, but they can give you an answer why certain of the Republicans, quote-unquote, are going for this compact. But if any of them would like to call and tell us, please be free to do so. Again, the number is 1-646-564-9915. You don't have to give your name. Just come in and tell us why you think some of these Republicans, these so-called conservative Republicans, are going for something like this. Another question that we have, here's the Western Montana Water Rights. If you want to look it up, it's westernmontanawaterrights.wordpress.com. Okay, and you got all the information you need there. There's another question. Elaine, how is this CSKT compact different from all of the other six tribal compacts in Montana?
I think in a nutshell, and I'm just kind of speaking broadly here because I certainly have not studied the other six compacts, But I'm aware that the other six compacts followed the Winters Doctrine, the Federal Reserve Water Rights, meaning the necessary water. The Winters Doctrine is a very good thing from 1908, and that refers to a Supreme Court case from 1908 that whose origins are in Montana, the Milk River and the Fort Belknap tribe early on in the late 1800s. As that area started getting settled, folks north of the Fort Belknap area were damming and blocking and depriving the Fort Belknap Reservation from water. And that went to court, and that's where the Winters Doctrine came from. And the Winters Doctrine said, where treaties or Congress or the executive branch creates a reservation, there is an implied Federal Reserve water right. And that's, again, common sense. There should be. You can't have an Indian reservation without water. Any more than you can have non-reservation areas without water, which is about to happen here. So the Winters Doctrine says that the tribes within their reservations should quantify their water needs for their lands and their people for now and in the future, and quantify that, and that becomes a Federal Reserve water right. That was the process, to my knowledge, that was followed by the other six compacts. Now here, it was flipped. It was reversed. The Salish Kootenai has yet to and has not quantified its Federal Reserve water rights, meaning the actual water that tribe needs for its people and its lands. They didn't do that. They didn't follow the Winters Doctrine, nor did anyone at the state level make them, require them to, which is fair. You know, I mean, the Winters Doctrine is very fair. What happened is they reversed it. The Salish Kootenai and the state of Montana says, they get all of this water. They don't have to quantify what they need for their reservation or their people. They get all the water. And they get Aboriginal rights. They get time immemorial. They get $55 million. And they can use that $55 million to dismantle the irrigation systems on the reservation. And that can be paid for by the state taxpayer. And, of course, you dismantle the irrigation system on that reservation and you destroy the economy, depopulate the area of non-tribal businesses and families and farms and ranches. And that's kind of a long-term goal. That's one way to get your reservation back. The sad part is the state of Montana seems to be facilitating that through this compact. So that's a long answer to why the other six compacts are how they're different. I think basically they follow the law. They have what they need, and they will always have what they need, and they should, but they don't have all this off-reservation in-stream flows from everything that flows anywhere near their reservation or beyond their reservation. They don't have this stuff the feds are feeding to the Salish Kootenai tribes and go get it all. Well, you know what's coming up? Kerr Dam is coming up, and the Columbia River Treaty is coming up for renegotiation. So the feds are very, very much eyeballing all the waters in western Montana. They can snag them early, more the better. But it's really perilous.
Wasn't there something? I don't know. Was there something in the treaty, the Winters Treaty, or one of the treaties, where it basically said that the tribes relinquish certain rights?
Yeah.
On the reservation.
No, they ceded or relinquished. You know, there were ancestral lands. As this continent was getting settled and discovered and settled and whatnot, there were thousands of tribes all over the place and here first, which is kind of something I just learned recently that gives me a little perspective, and that is in the 15th, 16th, and 1700s around the globe, when countries were exploring new continents and discovering new continents, there was the doctrine of discovery, which was an international policy and principle rooted off of the Magna Carta, the doctrine of discovery. And that meant he who arrived there could conquer and confiscate. And the doctrine of discovery was the way things were in settling new continents and exploiting. Now, one of the things that was different here, we have utilized in the early foundings of this country, utilized the doctrine of discovery. But there were specific choices of the early colonists and early constitutional, our framers and founders. There was a specific decision that was made regarding the Native Americans that were on this country, on this continent at a time when the doctrine of discovery was the way of doing business in those years. And that is, this country, these colonists, these founding framers, decided they would not exercise, under the doctrine of discovery, conquer and confiscate. What they used instead was Old English common law, property law. England and our, you know, most of our American common law comes from Old England and English common law, and everything was about property then. So they used property law, and that property law is what created the process of treaties that were executed with Indians across the country. The United States would say, we assume this was your property and we will pay for it. You will cede, relinquish, and we will buy from you all of this land, except this piece here will be your reservation. It was done under property law rather than conquer and confiscate. You know, now, had it been Germany or Spain or somebody else that came on this continent first, It would have been conquer and confiscate. You know, that's not what happened.
Well, that's interesting.
And when they say you stole our land, Thomas Jefferson vehemently disagrees with that. He said, no, we have paid for every piece, and in many cases, many times over. And we're not only doing that, we're still subsidizing tribal governments 200 years later. You know? So,
you know, that's interesting that you bring that up, because one of the things, I do everything online, basically. I don't even want to buy a newspaper for that. It's not worth it. So I do everything online, and what I like are the comments that you can see automatic. And anything that has to do with the compact, and if you go into the comments, you do have these people that come in, and right away they start criticizing, vilifying, calling you every name under the sun. You kind of know where they're coming from. And then they play the racist card automatically. It's like, this was our water, this was our land, and you stole it from us, and we're taking it back. So accept it.
Yeah, I heard that, you know, and I used to kind of make a goofy joke. I used to, you know, because I heard when I lived on the Yakima Reservation, and as I've traveled around the country, I have heard from a few, not many, but a few, well, we were here first. You stole our land. And my response to that is, well, you're really lucky that we were here second, you know, because we'd be studying you like the dinosaurs if it were some other country that conquered this continent, you know. Because we did not conquer and confiscate. We negotiated, we purchased, we paid for the lands that are now belong to the United States. So that we were here first thing is that it doesn't really fly. Yes, certainly they were. Certainly they were. But nobody stole
And when you think about, and when you think about especially the residents, non-tribal members on the Flathead Reservation, I think they bought that property outright, and there's another term, fee lands, and fee property, but...
Yeah,
so
that's any taxable property. Any taxable property is called fee land, Elena. If a property owner is paying taxes to his state, it's fee patented land. You know, and a lot of tribal members own fee patented land and pay taxes to the state. And a lot of tribal members own a lotted land that is now their land. Those allotments each came with an attached water right. And those tribal members that own their land and pay taxes to the state, they're about to lose their water rights too. So this is not an agreement that has wide support among the Salish Kootenai tribal members, not by any means. I even heard testimony, many of you have too, saying, this is a government that can't run a business. How are they going to manage this water? Why would you turn the state of Montana's water over to a government that can't operate its businesses or be successful with its businesses? You know, this is not a good thing for tribal members either.
No, because thank you for for clarifying that, because there are people there, and it's not.
Yeah, where I
don't
here
see
in
anything good about this thing.
where I live here in Wisconsin, I live in a lovely little neighborhood, and my next door neighbor is an enrolled tribal member, an enrolled Oneida, a very nice family. We live in a lovely neighborhood, and he owns his property just the way, you know, this home is owned. He pays taxes just the way anybody else does, and he's been encouraged, because it's a really lovely home. He's been encouraged by his tribal government to have the property put in trust. He's been told, hey, you won't have to pay taxes. Let us transfer the title to your home to the United States and in trust for you, and you can avoid taxes. And he doesn't want to do any such thing. And a lot of tribal members would not even consider doing any such thing, because they lack confidence. They'd rather own their home in fee and pay the taxes and be able to live their lives as they want to on their property than be beholden to a tribal government when they pass the title to their home to the United States. You know?
Well, you know, you're right. You know, when you look at some of the testimony up in Helena, and you can pull it up online and watch it, and you do see some people that are, it's apparent they're Indians, and they even say that they're tribal members of the CSKT, and they're not happy about what's going on. But then you also hear other things from these people. They're intimidated. And
absolutely.
I can see that. You know, like I said, they vilify, they criticize, they intimidate.
Yeah.
And you can imagine how these people on the reservation
are,
who go against this, are being intimidated.
Yeah.
Well,
they're just as affected. The tribal members are just as affected by this bill and will suffer the same consequences non-tribal businesses and landowners do. They won't be spared, and they know they won't be spared. And I hope the legislators understand that this is not something that is widely approved by tribal members. You know, there's such a big difference between tribal families and members that are, many of them are wonderful neighbors, that they're just silenced by the form of government they have and by the politics that they have. And they don't even have parental rights, so they have to be very cautious about not disagreeing with their tribal government, because somebody might knock on their door and say, you're a bad parent. And they don't have parental rights either. The tribal government has the parental rights of every enrollable child under 18. Now, I'm Cherokee. I'm probably more Cherokee than most Cherokees, and I'm not enrolled, but I'm really glad my grandchildren are over 18. I mean, there are areas in the Northwest in some of the tribes where people are moving off the reservations. They want a better quality of life. They'd rather make it on their own. And the tribal government population shrinks. Well, they have to keep it up there to get their federal funding. So they'll use the Indian Child Welfare Act to keep the population in place and to keep the people in line. And that's just egregious. But I don't want us to digress on things like that. I really want us to stay focused on Senate Bill 262 and this proposed compact. And I really hope that your listeners, if anybody's listening this evening, will share the podcast. I think you put this up on a podcast. I hope folks will send it around everywhere.
Yep.
And I really hope the legislators will think very long and hard on this. Because I am so willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. I've met and spoken with some marvelous legislators who truly smell the coffee here and truly get it. But they're being heavily influenced by way too many legal counsel that think it's really slick to circumvent the law instead of adhere
to
the law.
Well, you know, Elaine, I know you're just coming here, and I know you're getting ready to come to Montana, and I really appreciate you coming on the show because I know you're busy. And you're, again, folks, Elaine Willman will be coming here to Montana. She's probably packing as she's talking to us.
Well, I actually need to scoot off here if there's no other questions or something, because I really do need to finish packing.
Okay. But, you know, I don't know, because I've been seeing a lot of stuff that's coming through from the other counties, especially the Bitterroot Valley County.
Mm-hmm.
And these are supposedly irrigators that are supporting this thing. I'm seeing a lot of the irrigators, supposedly, quote again, unquote, irrigators, that are supporting this.
Let me say something about, this will be my fourth trip to Montana in the last 6 months, and I have met really awesome people up and down all those 11 counties. I've made some very good friends, and I've really come to love the Montana people. And I have a perception of the Montana people that I think are pretty correct. And I've lived all over the country, Elaine. I was a career Army officer's wife. I lived all over the South, years in California, years in Washington State. I'm now out here in the Midwest. And I've met people all over the United States, and there is nothing that beats the Montana people. And the reason for that is that they are good-hearted people who take care of themselves and their families. They're very responsible, accountable, great neighbors, hard workers, give you the shirt off their back, and they're trusting, and they're believing, and they're honest. And if they say something, you know, their handshake is legitimate, and their word is legitimate. Those kind of awesome people are really vulnerable to slicks, to sneaks, because they tend to think everybody else is honest and fair, too. They're very vulnerable. They're very vulnerable to conniving, to circumventing the law, to saying, don't worry. I mean, they're very trusting, even your legislators, very trusting, too trusting. I kind of think there's been an absence of information for years. There's been a kind of an intimidation and a bullying, like, oh, this is a done deal. Don't worry. We'll take care of it. You know? So, oh, okay. If you're that kind of really good-hearted Montana person, you truly want to believe your elected officials. You truly want to believe your governor. You truly want to believe your attorneys. So you're wide open, vulnerable to what is now the Salish-Kootenai Compact. And the people need to rise up and say, oh, no, you don't. Just that simple. They need to fill that Capitol Saturday morning. They need to say, oh, no, you don't. And God willing, the legislators will too.
You know, I think we've got one question, if you can stay with us for a few minutes, okay? Hi,
okay.
You're on the line with Elaine. What's your question or comment?
I have a question about the EIS.
Uh-huh.
And I'm from Lincoln County, and
I'm going to be up there.
Our senator is Mr. Vincent.
Yes.
And I understand there was a question about why would a supposed conservative senator be pushing for this, and I understand why, and I can't speak about it over the airwaves. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
The EIS, okay, it's been stated one is needed for the compact. However, within the compact and what they're proposing for the Flathead Irrigation Indian Project, and one of the first things they want to do is get out there and cement line all those ditches.
Yeah.
And if you do that, and if you take a look, Elaine, you've been around western or eastern Washington, I'm sure, around Moses Lake and the irrigation.
Yep.
And the irrigation recharge that over the decades that project has been established has, there are ponds and lakes, small lakes, all over an area that used to be desert. And now you get the migratory waterfowl that comes on in.
Uh-huh.
And there's federal laws for that. But to cement the ditches in on the Flathead Irrigation District, wouldn't you assume that that in itself would kick in an EIS? Are there migratory waterfowl?
Oh, sure, sure. That's
that
just one piece of it.
This?
You're absolutely right on. That's just one small piece of it. The environmental impacts in terms of any planned work that's going to be done, any redirection of irrigation waters or reduction of irrigation waters or cementing the ditches, all of that has profound environmental impact on the human environment, but on the natural, the recharge system and the landscape and the habitat and the whole thing profoundly affected by this compact. So you're right on.
Then my question would be is if there is, and it exists within the compact, that this is going to happen and that would require an EIS,
yes.
Then why would not the compact, the paper, then require an EIS if there is this known project that would, that's contained within it?
The paper identifies all kinds of projects that will have substantial impact on the environment. Most of the 140 pages identify those kinds of things that are going to happen, that are going to significantly reshape the water landscape and the environment throughout the area, you know. But we've been told, what the attorneys in the state are saying is, oh, no, this is legislation. The state legislature is not an agency. This is just their legislation, so it's categorically excluded. Well, the federal agency that mandates and controls and has oversight of the National Environmental Policy Act is the Council on Environmental Quality. The Council on Environmental Quality is a federal agency under the White House, and it has oversight. And in Title 40, at Part 1500, 1508.4 is a definition of categorical exclusions. And anything that individually or cumulatively significantly affects the human environment, much less the natural environment, requires an environmental impact. It is not categorically excluded. And if you think about it, and again, this is common sense, it's pieces of paper that create projects that affect the environment. This is a 1,400-page piece of paper that's going to have profound effect on the environment. If all pieces of paper were categorically excluded, which is the position of some of your Montana state attorneys, God love them, there'd never be a need for NEPA. I mean, you know, it would be Katie by the door. They'd just be doing anything they want. But the NEPA is a mandated federal policy that is being avoided, intentionally avoided. You know, so that will be one of the legal challenges. I mean, God forbid this thing passes. It will be immediately taken into court for its constitutional issues, for the taking issues, for all kinds of constitutional, federal and state constitutional, and it will go into court for failing to comply with NEPA. Immediately. I mean, they're asking for it. If you avoid the law, there's still a process to hold people accountable. Does that help?
Oh yes, thank you very much, Elaine.
You're very welcome, and I hope maybe I'll see you. I'm going to be up in Lincoln County towards the end of next week.
Well, I'll be in Helena.
Well, so will I. Saturday, I might see you Saturday.
Yes.
Very good. Thanks for calling in.
Okay, so folks, Elaine, like I said, I really thank her for being here and doing this show. She's getting ready to come to Montana, and she's going to make a lot of stops throughout Montana. Elaine, again, I thank you for coming on again. For those of you who listened, and there were a heck of a lot. Thank you all.
Good.
If you know people that had better things to do, like watching a certain basketball game tonight.
Oh, which I should be doing is my team in the state.
This is
I'm probably
podcasting.
The only one in Wisconsin not watching the game.
Yeah, well, what can I say? But anyway, this is podcasted, and I think that's what's important. So
yes,
you can listen to it. It's very important, though. Elaine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Elaine, and I'll see you soon.
We'll see you on Saturday, as a matter of fact.
Yes, very good.
Sure.
Looking forward to it. Okay, good
thank
night.
You. Take
bye
care.
Bye.
Good night. Bye. And I just want to say, again, Saturday, April, this coming Saturday, April 11th, 10 o'clock, you can look at the Western Montana Water Rights Group for information. There will be buses that will be going up to Helena. There's numbers that you can call. Bus rides will be available. $10, I think that's kind of cool. We got to get up there. And if you can't get up there, then you can also contact the legislature online, and you can call them. And all that information is... are you still on the line? 291? The person that was calling earlier, are you still on? I guess not. Okay, well, this is important. And like I said, it's our water, all right? As far as I'm concerned, there's a heck of a lot of stuff that's going on. It's all smoke and mirror kind of crap as far as I'm concerned. This is our water, folks. That's why I had this show. I'm not going to waste my time for all this other crap that's out there. Saturday is the bottom line. We get up there, and I am... You know, there's a lot of people out there that have a lot to say about things, and they whine and complain and all this other stuff, but when it comes down to putting their mouth where their money is or mouth where their rights are, they want somebody else to do it. This issue is very important. And again, a small group called the Western Montana Water Rights Group. I can't say any, I really thank them because they brought this to the attention and they were dedicated enough that they stopped this damn thing in 2013 to the point where we're paying attention to it now, okay? And that's why I'm backing them 100%. I'm tired of all the other BS that's going on about this, that, and the other thing. I don't see anybody putting their mouths actually for that stuff. You know, they complain and they whine. But with this thing, with this compact, it's really important. If anybody wants to say something, there's somebody on the line now, please say it. Because I'm going to be ending it. What is very important? I've been watching the Missoula trial taking over the Montana mountain water in Missoula. I've been watching that. I'm sorry, folks. This is really big. And it's just like Elaine said, it goes beyond water. It's control. And we have a problem here. It's called a drought. We're not experiencing it here in Montana right now because we got water. Okay, that's cool. So where's that water going to go? Big money? Are they going to send it someplace else? Once the CSKT has control over the water, and again, just like Elaine said, $55 million is going to be used to implement meters. For what? Think about that. Then you have the dam. That's something else that's there. Montana water is Montana water, okay? According to the Constitution and everything else, Montana, the state of Montana, protects the water for all of us. I don't like it, and I'm sorry, you have a foreign government who wants control over our water. And I'm not comfortable with that. I really am not comfortable with it. I'm not comfortable about what's going on with California and all the other places that are in a drought situation. Think about that, okay? I want Montana, my state, my legislators, the people I vote for, my Montana Constitution to protect my rights. And if they don't do it, I really think we should think definitely about recalling them. I don't want to get to that point. We got to stop it now. I hope to see you all Saturday in Helena. I'm going to be there. Elaine's going to be there. And a hell of a lot of other people are going to be there. But remember, so is the other side. We have to outnumber them. Thank you for listening. Thank you. We've got to start somewhere. If there's going to be a rebellion in this country, it's going to come from here regarding water. Thank you all for listening to The View from Montana. I'm going to sign off now. Thanks again. Good night.
Right.